KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Can men and women really be just friends? Sociology professor Anna Morocco says yes. But more importantly, there's a problem with this question. It ignores intersectional friendships. What Morocco calls the relationships between gay men and straight women, and straight men and gay women. Morocco's new book is called Odd Couples: Friendships at the Intersection of Gender and Sexual Orientation. She spoke at the University Bookstore on January 16th, 2013.
All right. So first of all, thanks everybody for coming tonight. I know it's cold. I know it's a weeknight. So I appreciate you making the time to come out here. So, Odd Couples. When I do these kinds of talks, I think it's really important for people to kind of hear how this came about. I am, as we said, an associate professor of sociology now down in Los Angeles at a liberal arts college called Loyola Marymount University. But when I started this, I was a graduate student at the University of California at Davis. And I was one of the floundering graduate students who wasn't quite sure what I was doing or why I was doing it. And my mentor at the time said to me, well, why don't you study something that's interesting to you, something that's going to really be important to you, that's significant to you? And so I said, well, okay. So, and she said, well, about the gay friendship thing, that seems to be something that's really important for you. And I said, well, yeah, it is. So I started to think about it. And one of my eventual dissertation chairs, I had two. Don't do that, by the way. It turned out fine, but I wouldn't recommend it as a strategy for those of you who are in graduate school. I had one of them said to me, she is a methodologist, Lynn Laughlin, and she said, she and her husband, John Laughlin, they're scholars, and they have this whole idea of starting from where you are methodologically. And the idea is, look at a question that's interesting to you, something that's meaningful, something that you see in your life, and start there, and then go outward and see, is that happening in the broader world, and see how that compares to your own life. So methodologically, that's one of the places I started. Also, I started this project in a particular cultural moment. At the time, I was living in the Bay Area, and my roommate was, or is still, a lesbian. And her best friend, she was dating a woman whose best friend was a straight man. And I happen to be, I am a straight woman in a very long, friendship with a gay man. So I was really interested in this, and how is this happening? And I know there must be more out there. And then the other thing that started to happen at this particular cultural moment was Will and Grace, the television show. And at that moment, when Will and Grace came out, I don't mean that as a pun, but at that moment when Will and Grace were showing on television, it was a big deal. There were not very many positive representations or even common representations of gay life. But there was this really important thing that was going on, and people were giving it was getting a lot of credit, attention. People looked very positively on it. And then there were the spate of movies that came out after that. There was the movie The Object of My Affection, which maybe not a critical hit, but the idea was there was a straight woman in love with her gay male best friend. There was My Best Friend's Wedding, where we have the straight woman who's kind of a disaster romantically, and she's got her gay best friend who saves her at every turn. We have that awful Madonna movie where she decides to have a baby with her gay best friend. The reason I bring all of these things up is because there was a particular cultural moment where all of these things were starting to become very common. And my interest was, well, why? So I've got this going on in my own life, but then I'm also seeing the representations happen. So this is why I started this project. Another thing was that I, as a graduate student, was somebody who was very interested in race and gender and class and the intertwining of all of those things, and also very interested in sexuality. And there was the common expectation that the common question that was being raised through movies and through everyday conversation, can men and women be friends? We know the When Harry Met Sally syndrome or phenomenon, whichever your perspective is. And the idea is, well, can they be friends? And of course, I thought, well, absolutely, yes. Yes, they can. But a lot of that, the question beyond that, behind that, is about, has a lot of assumptions attached to it. We've got heterosexuality, right? Well, to even ask the question, can men and women be friends, presumes heterosexuality. So there's that one assumption going on. A second thing that's going on behind that question is some idea that men and women are somehow fundamentally different from each other. And I think if we were to line up the things between women, men and women that were similar and different, we'd actually find more similarities than differences. So that's the second thing. There's these gender norms at play here. But what I wanted to know was, okay, so we this question of can men and women be friends, I know it can happen because I've got them in my own life and I see them happening elsewhere. But the issue seems to be sexual tension or some sort of sexual problematic, the potential for the romantic connection. And so my question was, well, in the absence or that of that or the presumed absence of that, because sexuality is not so nice and neat as a lot of us know, what does that look like? And so these are the kinds of things that were fueling my interest in this, not just simply my own friendships or what I saw happening in the media, but there's a question of, in the absence of these presumed heterosexual kinds of bonds that we expect to play out in a particular way, how do men and women interact with each other? And so that's how we started this, or we being me. Methodology. Now, I'm not going to talk a lot about my methodology here because this isn't a specifically academic presentation, but if anybody's really interested about the details of how I went about doing the study, I'm happy to share those with you. Just suffice to say that I interviewed 53 people. The interviews lasted between 45 minutes and an hour and a half. This started prior to some of the common conversations that are currently going on now. For example, there was not really at that time any movement towards same-sex marriage. This started, I was doing these interviews in 2000. And while same-sex marriage was certainly something that people were thinking about, it had not at all reached the kind of public discussion that's going on now. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. If there's not a lot of that material in this book, it's because of the fact that it actually predated some of the more common kinds of conversations that are going on. And I did most of the interviews in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's where I was living at the time. I met with everybody face-to-face. I would interview both sides of the friendship, but I would do it separately. So I would talk to one person, and then sometimes it would be right afterwards I'd interview their friend. Sometimes there would be several days that would elapse, sometimes weeks, just depending on what was happening in their lives and in mine at the time. So like I said, I'm happy to share methodologically how I came up with my conclusions in the book, but I don't want to spend a whole lot of time talking about it right now because those people who aren't academics probably don't care that much. But I'm happy to answer questions for people who have them. Okay, so I should probably read from the book. The themes covered in the book, just to give you a sense of what's in here. This is an academic book, and so it relies a lot upon a lot of academic scholarship about friendships, about social relationships, about gender, about sexuality, all of these different things. One of the things that you might be suspecting from what I've said already is the idea that friends are much more likely to be similar than different. And what do I mean by that? There's a colloquialism in our everyday life that opposites attract, right? Opposites attract. Think people that are so widely different from each other find each other to be this fascinating kind of person, and they glom onto each other. Maybe. But actually, what research says is that people who are in close relationships with each other are more likely to be similar than different. And what do I mean by that? Maybe they have personality quirks that are slightly different. They like different music. They like to spend their time a little differently. But in general, when you look on the socio-demographic characteristics. And what I mean by this are things like age and education level, religion, political kinds of leanings. People tend to be more similar than they are different. And these friendships, despite the fact that they're from different sexes and different sexual orientations, they're actually quite common. That in general, you see a lot of commonality. So first thing I want to do is read some what I call snapshots of the friendships. And I do this because it's nice to have just a sense of, rather than talking about them, to give you a little bit of insight into the actual friendships themselves. So first I'm going to start with Emily and Patrick. Emily and Patrick have been friends for more than a decade. Patrick was the first friend that Emily had when she relocated for a job nearly 15 years ago. Patrick, her coworker, showed her around her new city. They're both white and in their 40s, and they both work in the same office dedicated to environmental preservation. They both are in long-term relationships. Emily had a commitment ceremony to celebrate her same-sex partnership with Stacy several years ago, and Patrick has been married for 10 years. Patrick characterized his close bond with Emily, and he said, quote, "I have a tendency to think, you know, outside of the context of this conversation, if you had said, who are your close friends, I would name, you know, a friend from high school who I'm still close with, my wife, maybe nobody else. But when I consciously include what I do at work, then it's really clear that Emily is a close friend." Despite both friends' mutual descriptions of closeness, Patrick and Emily admitted that these days they infrequently socialize with each other outside of the work setting. Emily had as I mentioned before, Emily has a long-term partner, and they had a commitment ceremony. This is, again, before legal marriages were allowed in many places in the United States. Well, not many, a few. But Washington, good job. So Emily was talking about their commitment ceremony that they had. She says, "Patrick comes to birthday parties, and he came to my wedding. A number of other people I work with did too, and we did this weekend thing where people who wanted to come the whole weekend, they could. In fact, his whole family did the weekend thing. He was definitely one of my, you know, special friends at the wedding ceremony. I remember when he met my brother and his wife. Later they were like, yeah, we could tell that you and Patrick are really close and know each other really well. We had a barbecue before the wedding, and I remember sitting at the table thinking that Patrick was just as much a brother as my brother. Like, my brother was on my left, and Patrick was on my right. It just felt like, you know, oh, my true brothers are going to meet each other finally." So this is to give you some sense of what these relationships are like and how they're characterized in the words of the people who are experiencing them. There's one other piece I want to read for you. Okay, here it is. One of the things that was particularly interesting about the Patrick and Emily friendship was they talk a lot about their work friendship, but there was an interesting piece of this that shows how gender was playing out within the friendships. Patrick was explaining the benefits that he reaps from having Emily present in the workplace, and he says, quote, "We've, I think, talked to each other about our feelings of professional inadequacy, which is something that's hard to talk about with a spouse, because a spouse is going to say, quote, you know, you're fine, you're really great, just don't think about it." And Patrick continues, "It's different to be able to talk about it with someone at work and to be talking at a more detailed level saying, you know what, my project handling skills suck. I'm good at project development, but I'm just not following through. I'm letting my deadline slip and feeling really bad about that. That's a conversation that's something in our friendship that's safe ground. I don't know if this is one of your later questions, but I think it's safer to have that kind of a conversation with a woman. I don't know that I would be so ready to have that conversation with a man." So what Patrick is talking about is the fact that in the workplace, it's helpful to have this difference of sexes, and specifically because of the fact that he feels like he can be more open with her because he feels like she'll understand. He goes on to say how their particular bond allows for a deeper friendship and says, quote, "Sometimes when you've got a gender difference, a friendship has some sort of sexual overtones or whatever, and there can be like a flirtatious kind of aspect of a friendship that maybe can sometimes lead further. On one hand, it can be plus for a relationship, but a lot of times it can be negative, especially in the long run. But because I think that Emily and my friendship has never really had that, maybe there's some distance in ways that there otherwise wouldn't have been." So what he's talking about, and this is something that got repeated throughout many of the friendships, which is partly why I'm reading this to you now, is a lot of the friends talked about the lack of sexual chemistry, lack of sexual tension as being a benefit to their friends. Now I have to the friendship. Now I have an entire chapter of the book that talks about how sexuality is not so cut and dry, and therefore it was sometimes very complicated within these friendships. But this is a really common theme that came forth in people's discussions of why the friendships were so close.
Anna Morocco, the author of Odd Couples, Friendships at the Intersection of Gender and Sexual Orientation. Morocco spoke at the University Bookstore on January 16th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
We'll hear more from Anna Morocco in just a minute. It's 8:22.
Every Saturday night, The Swing Years and Beyond takes you on a tour of popular music from the 1920s through the 1950s. I'm Amanda Wilde. Join me for The Swing Years and Beyond Saturday nights starting at 7 o'clock on 94.9 KUOW.
Much of the entertainment industry runs on the blood of unpaid interns. The glamour of working with noted directors or big stars lures them in. The dangled promise of a future career keeps them there and into the night. But the truth is, the industry is built on luring them in and spitting them back out onto the street. Eric Glatt found himself in such a position. He looked into the law and became suspicious that his employer's reliance on interns was illegal. So he sued. We'll hear his story tomorrow afternoon at 2. This is 94.9 KUOW News and Information. Mostly cloudy tonight, a chance of showers and a low around 41. Patchy fog tomorrow morning, then partly sunny in the afternoon, a high of 51.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Anna Morocco calls the relationships between gay men and straight women and straight men and gay women intersectional friendships. By interviewing many intersectional friendships, Morocco found the stereotypical reason these relationships are formed is false and limiting in the way we view family, friendship, and social norms. Morocco spoke at the University Bookstore on January 16, 2013. Next, she continues reading interviews from her book.
All right, so now I'm going to read a little bit from Scott and Ruth. So Scott and Ruth have known each other for about 25 years. They met each other. They were both playing in bands in San Francisco. They've been friends for 25 plus years. So they've known each other for a really long time. Ruth says that when she first met Scott, he was living in the gay hotel. Apparently there was a gay hotel in San Francisco. I didn't know that there was such a designation, but that's what she said. And she therefore took it for granted that he was gay. Similarly, Scott always assumed that Ruth was straight because she had been married to his friend. So that this was the question of how did they know that each other, did they have to come out to each other, how did this work out? So Scott explains here, I'll go back here. Ruth was explaining her tendency to have a lot of gay male friends. She said, "I've had gay male friends since I can remember. I've always gravitated toward artsy people. Extending on beyond that, usually musicians and artists and then gay people are always a part of trendy sorts of crowds, especially when I was young. Before I knew Scott, when I was a teenager, I had really close gay male friends. But they're all dead." And that's the end of the quote. At the end of her statement, what she's referring to is the fact that she lost a large part of her friendship network during the HIV and AIDS epidemic of the 1980s, as did Scott. This topic arose many times during their interview and also in some other people's interviews as well. Scott says, quote, "I've probably put too much pressure on Ruth because I don't maintain social ties with anyone. Almost everyone I was friends with died, and I have not been social since, so I haven't met a lot of people. So Ruth has had to deal with the burden of me," end quote. They talk more about the losses that they had. But one of the things that was really, that came about because of the AIDS and HIV epidemic that was going on was their discussion of parenting together. Scott and Ruth both acknowledged that in addition to his HIV diagnosis being a major concern in his life, it also influenced a decision about parenting. And he says, quote, "Me and Ruth used to talk about having a baby together until we found out I was HIV positive," Scott said. "So I've always had the sensation that Ruth's daughter, Caroline was mine." So she ended up having a child with another person. And he was so close to them that he often felt like he was parenting by proxy because of the fact that he had such a close relationship with her daughter. So let's see. So just in conclusion on, for this section, Scott described his friendship with Ruth, and he says, quote, "I just really like Ruth. I like doing things together and working with her. She's like my best friend, baby sister, just like to do things with her. I value my friendships and family, and Ruth's one of the most important people. I'm tempted to say the most important. She's the person who's always been there. When my dad died, I went back and realized how important my family is, but they're not the ones there in the same way for me that Ruth is. They don't know me like Ruth does. Nobody knows me the way Ruth does, so she's the most important," end quote. So part of the reason I think it's really important to give you a sense of what these friendships are like is because when I first brought up the cultural images that we have of the gay man, straight woman friendship in particular, because we don't have very many cultural images of the lesbian straight man or lesbian, now we've got a few images of lesbian couples, but they're usually not very realistic. But what we usually see are these kinds of superficial kinds of friendships. The gay men and straight women like to go shopping together or go clubbing together. And what we see here is a much deeper kind of friendship going on. This is something where people are building. They often have strong connections that last very long periods of time. And so that's part of the reason I'm reading these sort of snapshots for you, is to just give you a sense of what we're talking about. Okay. So I'm just going to focus a little bit on gender within the friendships now, because there's lots of things I could focus on. Like I said, there's a chapter about family, there's a chapter about sexuality, there's a chapter about how people get politicized. But most people are interested in the gender stuff, I find. When I mention something about the gay-straight friendships, people are usually, you know, really interested in the gender part. So that's what I'll talk a little bit about now. And then I'll talk for about 10 more minutes, maybe 5 more minutes, and then I'll be happy to take whatever questions you might have. Okay, so gender. I'm assuming that we have sort of a common vocabulary for talking about gender. What I mean by gender is sort of people's felt experiences of who they are, which is generally male and female, right? Although we obviously know that we've got some sexuality researchers in the crowd tonight. We know it's much more complicated than that sometimes. So within the friendships, one of the things that was most interesting to me is the gender dynamics. I knew that given the depictions of the friendships, that there is this sort of expectations of heightened gay male identity as being a certain type. I think of the character Jack on Will and Grace as being that particular type, kind of overblown, stereotypical. Obviously, we know that there are lots of gradations to that, but the stereotype, that's the one that exists, the most common one. But I knew from my own close friendship that was not my experience. My best friend wears cardigan sweaters and does not go clubbing. He's like an old man, and he's never wanted to go clubbing. And so I know that that's not all there is to these friendships, just anecdotally. So the gender part is really interesting to me. So I'm going to read a couple sections from this book. And one of the larger arguments I have that goes on within the book is the idea of gender policing versus, That's not good. Gender cops and robbers is what I call it, right? The idea of gender policing and the idea of expanding what our expectations of gender are. So one of the ways, and this I'm reading now, so just so you know, one of the ways that gay men and straight women I interviewed police gender is by reinforcing the appearance norms for straight women. Many of the straight female participants indicated that they valued the attention their gay male friend pays to their appearance. We know, because of societal sexism, that it's really important. The way women look is given a lot of social value. The gay male friends often are very helpful in letting their female friends know that they look nice, right? This is something that's socially valued. But I also consider this or characterize this as gender policing because it's sort of reinforcing the idea that what you are is how you look, right? Obviously, it's more complicated than that. So here I have Mark saying of his friend Christina. He says, a lot of my gay friends say, you're living vicariously through Christina. You want her height, you want her boobs, her body, her figure. She's very much a woman, very much a girl. She shaves every day. We call Sundays pedicure Sundays. We get them every Sunday. There's not a masculine bone in her, honestly. So what he's basically doing here is appreciating her, what is called by West and Zimmerman, who are academics, her accomplishment of conventional femininity, and showing that he appreciates the fact that she meets those conventions and finds them to be she does it very well. She accomplishes them very well. So that's one way that gender gets policed. Another way that happens is what I call the theme that is a gay man trapped in a straight woman's body. And this is something that the women themselves discussed. Let's see. Monique, who's a 30-year-old straight woman, she says she is very queer identified. And she doesn't identify, she says, with being ghetto. It's a state of mind, not a place, and she likes men. So she likes to call it being gay in a woman's body. The idea is that it encompasses her ability to move in and out of marginalized identities. Jesse, her friend, clarified, and he says, I always tell Monique she is a gay man trapped in a straight woman's body. She's more of a gay man than I am sometimes. He calls her gayer than gay. So the idea is that he is placing this sort of lens of what the expectation is of gay men on her and saying she's a gay man trapped in a straight woman's body. So sort of reinforcing what a straight woman should be and what a gay man should be simultaneously. Gender policing. Another way that gender gets policed is the expectation that women are going to be endless sources of love and support, unconditional. The idea is that there's a great quote in here. Pete, an Asian, no, this is not him. Here it is. Frank, a 32-year-old white gay man, explained the comfort he found in his friendship with Rebecca, a 32-year-old straight mixed race woman. And he said, quote, no matter how I screw up or bottom out or what horrible things I say or do or how horrible I feel about myself, I know she'll always be there for me. Even in the worst situation, I know I can count on her to help me out. And while this is a very nice and good thing that we all hope we can rely on our friends for this kind of support, it was uneven in that the men tended to more commonly identify this quality in their female friends than vice versa, thus sort of reinforcing the idea of women being sort of nurturing and all of those things that we love about them, but still a stereotype. Okay. This was true of both the straight women and the lesbians. So this was not just true in the straight women's situation. And then there was one last thing I wanted to talk about before I talk about gender robbers, meaning our gender barrier breakers. And this is the idea that straight men seem to have trouble. There was some slippage in terms of the ways they characterize their lesbian friends. And so, for example, on the one hand, they would talk about how they were able to have these close friendships with women who were lesbians because there wasn't the pressure of feeling like they needed to act with male heterosexual sort of bravado. But on the other hand, they would do things like ask them for advice about being in relationships with women. And so it was sort of simultaneously using this lens to say, you're not really a woman I'm interested in sleeping with, and so therefore I want to ask you questions, but since you do sleep with women, could you maybe give me some pointers about what you think women might like? And it's an interesting way of laying those kinds of expectations one on top of the other. On the one hand, normative, on the other hand, not really. And what I mean by that is what Jill says here. She's 31 and her friend is Paul. She's a lesbian, he's a straight friend. And she says, he's asked me advice about being in a relationship with a woman. And she says, what do they want? She says, I'm trying to figure it out too, and I'm a woman. And she says, women want to talk a lot. They want to talk about their feelings. It's maintenance. They just want you to listen. They don't want you to solve the problem. And then Paul says, he says to her, come on, give me some pointers, right? So on the one hand, he's really identifying with her sex, but not necessarily recognizing that the woman she's sleeping with might want something, or in relationships with, here we're talking only about sex, really, might want something different, might be looking for something different. He's sort of conflating women all together. All right, and lastly, we've got our gender atypical things that are going on. Now, this might seem ironic, however, I call them gender outlaws, by the way. It's Kate Bornstein, who is a trans activist woman, uses that term, gender outlaws. And the first thing I want to describe is kind of a spin on something that I just described as being gender policing. So there's a little irony here, which is the characterization of the straight male friend as a woman in a man's body by the lesbian friends, and sometimes by other friends as well. So typically, this label was invoked not by the straight man himself, but by his lesbian friend. So for example, Vanessa characterized the differences between herself and her friend Bruce. She's a lesbian, he's a straight man. He watches films, and I watch movies. Something's got to get blown up for me to be interested, she laughs. I think maybe he's really a lesbian and I'm really a straight guy. It would explain so much. So here she's playfully commenting on their inversely gendered interests. And she's really talking more about that than any real questioning of his sexual orientation. Jill and Paul, our friends who we were just talking about a minute ago, the one who asked her for pointers on relationships with women, she describes Paul saying, quote, he's so nurturing, and I always say that he's very in touch with his feminine side. He's a woman in a man's body, end quote. So again, somebody else characterizing them that way. Why do I call this outlaw behavior? I call this outlaw behavior because it is something that is not necessarily the gender norm that we would expect out of heterosexual men, right? And so that is why I'm calling it the gender outlaw behavior. Does he mean to be a gender outlaw? Probably not. But this is being characterized in that way, and that's why I'm talking about it in the way that I am and characterizing it in that way. This is the other sort of ironic point I have here, is the idea of the fag hag, right? Have we all heard the fag hag term before? If you haven't, I'm glad, because it needs to be retired. However, there is the concept of the fag hag is the idea of a straight woman who is really involved with and interested in connecting with gay men. I look at it, though, because of the ways that the women themselves are describing this tendency in their own lives as more of a gender outlaw kind of way of behaving. Zoe, who's a straight woman in the study, explains here. She says, quote, you get to be a whole person. Back when I was younger and more concerned with these things, I didn't have to be feminine. I could be myself, and I could be loud, and I could be funny, and I could be bawdy, and all of those things would be totally embraced. That's what people would think was great about me, as opposed to being considered unfeminine. I think I gave that up, that whole concept. But earlier in my evolution, I think I thought I had to be a certain way, how you're supposed to eat like a bird and all of that stupid stuff, do aerobics, be a certain size and all of those things. None of that mattered. And, you know, my gay friends certainly will aesthetically appreciate that, perhaps in somebody, but it wasn't going to be a part of my being in their life because they thought I was great and I could take up space and be myself. And so she, Zoe, talks about having the fag hag labeled applied to her many times over her life. But in this case, what she's basically talking about is this greater acceptance of who she can be and who her genuine self is. And again, that's why I call this the gender outlaw kind of behavior. And then the lesbian and gay men in the study talk a little bit less about these sort of gender outlaw kinds of things. The lesbians in the study talked more about enjoying certain kinds of activities with their straight male friends. So, for example, they talked a lot about things like playing pool and playing basketball and being able to do things that are coded as more masculine kinds of activities, even though some of those things luckily are changing in our world these days with more women athletes in Title IX and things like that. But that's one of the things they talked about. Also, they talked about some of that when in the company of their straight men, male friends, they often felt more safe. And what I mean by that is if you're out at night and you're walking, they would comment on the fact that when they were with a straight male friend, they often would feel greater bodily safety. Not even because their friend was a particularly athletic person or would be able to, you know, throw down or anything like that, but the idea is that just by virtue of being in the company of a man gives you privilege to be able to walk the streets differently than you might as a woman by yourself. And so that was one of the things they talked about as well. And that's kind of a tough one for me. Is that outlaw behavior? Is that policing? Hard to say exactly. But the idea is by virtue of connection with straight male friends, they had greater freedom to walk about. And lastly, and this is the last thing I'll say, well, not the last, but close, is that the gay men really didn't talk about gender outlaw behavior. And they didn't talk about their friendships with women giving them greater ability to behave in gender non-normative ways. Partly it might be because they have that acceptance from other gay male friends. Partly it could be because they're already in a non-normative space, and so therefore they don't necessarily need their straight women friends to create that kind of a context for them. But while a lot of the gay men talked about how important the friendships were, it wasn't in the same kind of gendered ways that the other types of individuals talked about.
Anna Morocco, the author of Odd Couples, Friendships at the Intersection of Gender and Sexual Orientation. Morocco spoke at the University Bookstore on January 16th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
We'll hear more from Anna Morocco as she takes questions from the audience. That's coming up in just a minute. It's 8:44.
Sometimes it doesn't matter what you do, how hard you struggle, where you run and hide. The universe has its own plan. This week from NPR and PRX, Snap Judgment proudly presents The Hand of Fate. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Snap Judgment, Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. You're listening to 94.9 KUOW News and Information. I'm Rainey Cohen. Every Super Bowl, advertisers try to make their spots the most talked about. Some companies have already released their ads, and a few of those are already generating controversy. We'll talk about how to impress the biggest audience on television tomorrow on our morning news magazine between 5 and 9. Temperatures tonight around 41 degrees, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers. Patchy fog tomorrow morning and then partly sunny by the afternoon with a high of 51. And on Saturday, mostly cloudy in the morning and then mostly sunny with a high of 53. David Wilma is a historian and served on the Seattle Police Department's Professional Accountability Review Board. He'll take us back to the University of Washington campus, where he was a police officer in the late 1960s. His story at 9:06.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Anna Morocco is a sociology professor at Loyola Marymount University and the author of Odd Couples, Friendships at the Intersection of Gender and Sexual Orientation. Morocco spoke at the University Bookstore on January 16, 2013. Next, she takes questions from the audience. The first question is, how did you find the intersectional couples to interview for the book?
I did what's called snowball sampling, which a friend, my sister's partner, actually says he thinks I made that up. But it's, I promise I didn't. The idea is you start in a network of people that you know. And what happens is they refer you to other people who refer you to other people. And the idea is it sort of snowballs out. I kind of think of it when I teach my methodology classes. I talk about it in terms of the cartoon, like Wile E. Coyote at the top of the hill. And the snowball starts rolling down. And by the time it gets to the bottom, it's really big. That's the snowball sample. So the idea is I started with contacts in the communities in the Bay Area that I had and went outward from there. I also put some ads on Craigslist and found some people that way. I also sent flyers out to local organizations, and I was specifically targeting the LGBT organizations for those people who, LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities, thinking that it's gonna be easier to find, if I'm targeting those organizations, it'll be easier than just targeting general straight people and trying to find straight people who have gay friends. So that's how I did it. Excuse me. Other questions?
Did you have any bisexuals in the mix?
That's such a good question. So what's hard about this? One of the things that's complicated about this is anybody who studies sexuality knows that people's sexual orientation isn't necessarily indelible, right? It can sometimes change over time. There is one person who said she wasn't sure if she was bisexual or not. So maybe. And I had to, in some ways, limit the sample because I really wanted to look at the gendered components of the gay man, straight woman, and lesbian, straight man. I tried not to bring any bisexual people into the sample because I think it complicates sort of those gendered pieces of it. So I was specifically not looking for bisexuals, but I would have loved to do bisexuals, because I think it would be a really interesting look at the negotiation that goes on in those circumstances, because I would imagine there's even more negotiation of the gender and sexuality because of sort of a lot of the stereotypes that exist about bisexual people. You know, this idea that they're sort of flexible and of course, not to be offensive at all, but people often call bisexuals greedy, right? Because they can choose from lots of different groups of people. And so to me, those kinds of stereotypes might affect the kinds of dynamics I would see within the friendships themselves. Yeah.
Is So since your sample set was largely from the Bay Area, you completed the book with these 53 friend sets.
Yep.
Afterwards, when you talk to people at seminars in this country or other places, have you met odd couples that, because they're in a different region or come from a very different culture, they're just wildly different, or are they more similar than you might have suspected?
That is a very good question. So one of the critiques I had of the work initially was, well, this is just another, and there's a lot of work that gets done in the Bay Area, right? I mean, it's kind of a mecca for doing any work on gay and lesbian populations, because there's such an established community of people there. So that was one of the critiques I had initially was, well, how do we know this isn't just a Bay Area thing? And I think, so the answer, to answer the question, I haven't seen that there is a lot of difference. However, I have not spent a lot of time continuing the studies in other places. I think it would be great. I think that to really understand how these friendships play out, I would love to do a sample of like more rural populations. You know, go into Nebraska, for lack of a better. Like, I just know that there's a very large lesbian population, for example, at the University of Nebraska. That would be really cool to do a study that was in Nebraska and in a lot of the Midwestern, people call them the flyover states, right? I don't think they're so, I like them. But the idea, though, is that I think there might be something different going on depending on the quality, not the quality, but the, depending on the population, right? You know, is it urban? Is it more rural? What is the role of religion in that population? What's interesting, too, is, and this wasn't the question you asked, but it's one that's kind of related, is would there be a difference in people who were, that I studied, which were fully adults, people who are for 21 to age 70-something, would there be a difference between this sample that I collected in 2000 versus the sample that would be present today? Because I think that there is something going on with the younger populations that is really different from the context that I grew up in. I often have to tell the students, and when I'm teaching classes, there was nobody out as gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender in my high school. Nobody. Like, were there gay people there? Sure. Were they out? Absolutely not. And so I think, and if you look at the demographics and what are the attitudes towards things like same-sex marriage, for example, or all kinds of different things, there's a very big difference in younger populations and older populations. And so that's something that's related to the geographical piece to me, in that I might get something a little bit different if I were to do this study with a younger population and in a different geographical region.
The question from the audience is, did you find more work friendships, or were they all over the place?
They were from all over the place. There were definitely the work friendships. I mean, there were, but it's really, when they start talking about the work friendships, they sound like more than just work friendships. So it's not just that they only interact in the workplace, but that it actually sort of, exactly, and that's where the friendship started. There were a lot of different places. Workplaces, graduate school was a big one. This was a really highly educated group of people. Again, and a lot of it could be biased because, you know, I said I started from my own networks and they went outward. Well, who am I more likely to be friends with? It's people who are highly educated because I was a PhD student when I was doing it. So there's a lot of reasons why that happens, not intentionally, but, you know, like ends up being with like. There were also friendships through that started when they were children. When little children, from elementary school, where some they navigated a coming out situation from one of the friends. There was really just a whole range. The same ways that we would think of people becoming friends, you know, in not in the population. So, you know, work, common interests, participation in a group, friends from school. Neighbors. I mean, there's a whole range. Yeah. So nothing really that special about, as it turns out, nothing really that special about them. They're a lot like other friends, basically. Anything?
The question from the audience is, do the people in these intersectional friendships deal with sexual tension?
Oh, yes. Yes, they did. It's interesting, and part of the reason, it's funny, so when I started this work, it was a long time ago, right? I mean, this was like, when I started even conceiving of the work, it was in the late 90s. So, which, you know, to me doesn't seem like that long ago, but to my students, they were born then, basically. So, it's kind of horrifying. But, so, and, you know, when we were conceiving of, a lot of the scholarship has really shifted in this time, where sexuality is not really viewed as this indelible kind of category. At the time, it was like, you are gay, or you are lesbian, and if you are on the way to lesbian or on the way out of being gay, it's very suspect, right? Now we've got a lot more, there's understanding about the fluidity of people's lives. There were a couple really interesting pairings in the book. One was a lesbian straight man who they said they had an affair. That's what they termed it. And so they had a sexual relationship that went on for many months. And they sort of, they decided that it wasn't going to work out for various reasons and went on to different partnerships. Was there still sexual tension? It sounded like it to me, but you know. But they maintained the friendship, exactly. And then there was another one where it was, and I often use this as an example in when I'm teaching methodology classes. There was a gay man, straight woman who I was interviewing not at the same time, but in the same space. So one I would talk to, and the other one was off doing something, and then the other was supposed to come back. It's the only interview where there was it became very chilly. And what I mean by that is I asked the question, have you ever been sexually involved? And I was interviewing the gay man first, and he's like, well, what do you mean sexually involved? And I'm like, well, were you ever sexually involved? Like, whatever you think sexually involved means, you know. Well, no, not really. And I'm thinking, okay. And then the gal comes out afterwards, and he was elsewhere. And I asked the question, and I asked the same question, have you ever been sexually involved? Totally stony face. What did he say? And I'm like, and then very little happened in that interview afterwards. It was sort of like that was the last question that really got answered. And the rest was very stony faced. So I thought, okay, well, something's happening here that I'm not going to be able to discern. So I just sort of let it go. I really wanted to do an intervention with them in a way. I wanted to be like, so what do you think happened? But that wasn't really part of it. That would have just been gross curiosity more than any real scholarship. So, there were obviously, and then there were just different gradations of that too. Like, you know, suddenly the straight man says, suddenly my shirt was off and I don't know why. And I'm like, okay. So there are just sort of these where it's not, they're not really navigating the tension in some cases, just sort of like it became a sexualized kind of context. But there were those two instances where there was very clear, one where they admitted that there was the relationship and the other one where there was something going on that I never really fully understood. So yeah, so it is, it's more complicated than just either or. All right. Well, thanks again for coming, everybody. I really appreciate the questions and the attention and that you're here. So thank you.
Anna Morocco, the author of Odd Couples, Friendships at the Intersection of Gender and Sexual Orientation. Morocco spoke at the University Bookstore on January 16th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
It's 9 o'clock. Today's KUOW Day sponsors are Claire and Christine Bourne, wishing Randy Bourne a happy birthday. Today's other KUOW Day sponsor is the Feeney Hirsch family, wishing Jackson Hirsch a great birthday tomorrow.
Pubs in rural parts of Ireland are becoming less crowded. Pub owners say drunk driving laws have discouraged the traditional rural customer.
He's not going out anymore. We need to keep the fabric of rural Ireland alive, and we feel that the pub is a very, very important part in that community role.
So pub owners are lobbying to legalize drinking and driving in the Irish countryside. That's next time.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.